Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Hello, Blood River Radio family. I'd like to thank you so much. Once again, I said early on when we opened the program, I'd like to thank the people that keep us on the air with their precious donations. Also, I'd like to reiterate, we have the man and only, the one and only, the Bitter Ender coming on now, and we're going to have a great Confederate History Hour. But before we came on, I would just like to remind you people to this show is dedicated to what I call the Charlottesville Five. It was Matt Goodwin, Matt the Mole Goodwin. He used to be a co-host here. He got his priorities mixed up, went off to have his babies and got married, man. I'm thinking, where the hell's your priorities? Anyway, he had Matt the Mole Goodwin, yours truly, Eddie Miller, and I'm going from left to right in that photo I don't have it up right now. And there was the Bitter Ender himself, Gene Andrews, Simon Rose of South Africa, Brother Simon, and Brother Rich Hamblin. Those five, we went to Charlottesville together. I tell you what, it was so emotional. That was August the 12th of 2017. Actually, we got there. I think we left on the 11th, and we got there in the Charlottesville. We got up to a compound outside of Charlottesville. The next day, the 12th of August 2017, we went into that bloody hell, that Battle of Charlottesville. And the next day, that photograph, I'm going to see if I can put it on our website. Well, it is on our website. People, if you go into bloodriverradio.com and you go in and you pull up, click on media, our media, that photograph of the five guys, the five brothers, our friendship, our brotherhood was forged in by God in battle. It really was. And so this show is dedicated to us five guys. And I just happen to be included, you know, but I'm not doing it for me. Also, and especially, I'd like to keep you, ask you to keep Rich Hamblin in your prayers and Rand Owen, because they're suffering right now. They got some health issues. But anyway, the show is dedicated, even though it's Confederate History Hour. And before we go into Confederate History, Bitter Ender, do you have anything to add to that, to the Charlottesville Five Memorial?
No, I think people now are waking up to the fact that this was another screw job by the government to stifle any kind of dissent. We had a permit to be there and speak up for the statue of General Robert E. Lee in Lee Park in Charlottesville, Virginia. A Virginian in Virginia made sense to us, but then we were attacked by the Antifas and the Black Lives Don't Matter to other blacks, and the police and the Virginia Highway Patrol did absolutely nothing. And it was a set-up deal by the mayor, the slimy mayor of Charlottesville, and his police, his DEI, Affirmative Action Police Chief, to attack people who were conservatives and speaking up for our history. So, you know, it really tainted my opinion of police and the judicial system in this country. And then the only people that were put on trial after it were not the violent thugs that attacked us, but were the people that organized the event to go there. And they were the ones that were put on trial. You know, like, just by showing up, we were at fault just by showing up. And, you know, they pretty much bankrupted the League of the South. It was just really disgusting the way, not only the day that August 17th in 2017, but the aftermath of that and the crooked dealings and wheelings and dealings that the so-called judicial system in this country put all the people through that were actually there. So that's my two cents worth.
Well, I'd just like to help people one more time. I cannot tell you people how special I feel to these people that went up there with Gene Andrews being one of them. There's nothing I wouldn't do for Gene and these other fellows, and they know it, and they would do the same for me. But you're talking about, and I'm excluding myself, the cream of the cream. The guys that went up there stuck it, put it all in line, and lucky we survived, lucky we didn't get killed, and lucky still that we didn't go to prison. But I just like to keep those guys in mind. And we weren't the only ones there, but I feel really – I think we – and I'll close out with this before we go to Confederate history. We, the Charlottesville Five, amongst others, we were in the history books now. That was a major event and not only just the United States, but in the world. Paul Fromm gave a great breakdown there. He said it scared the living hell out of the establishment because he said young people were standing up and young people were marching there. So they had to do something. They had to come down on us hard. But anyway, people, once again, I'll close it. I'll be quiet. Just keep Rich Hamblin, Brother Rich Hamblin, and Brother Rand Owen. Rand Owen was in Charlottesville too. He wasn't with us. He was with another group. But they're in bad. They're suffering right now. Keep them in your prayers and pray hard. Anyway, back to you, Britta Render. I just wanted to make sure. Also,
bringing that up, keeping that in front of people, keep reminding everyone about what a rotten federal government we have in Washington, and it trickles down to all the states as well. And this was local police and Virginia Highway Patrol, and they were just as rotten as the feds, the FBI, the fumbling, bumbling idiots. And so hopefully we've got somebody in Washington now that's going to change a lot of this, but we can only hope. But up until now, it's really been bad, the garbage that we've had dumped on us. So anyway, okay.
We didn't catch it as hard as they did in Dresden. Also, the Dresden. Well, we were hooked on a couple up dedicated to Dresden and the Charlottesville Five. But I'll shut up now.
Okay.
People live there. So go ahead, Gene.
Hour, we've very graciously been donated to us as the Confederate History Hour. And last week, you know, we talked about the two battles in Tennessee on the Tennessee and Cumberland River, Fort Henry on February 6th and Fort Donelson the 13th through the 16th of February. And those losses pretty much destroyed the Mid-South for the Confederacy and turned it over to the enemy. And there was only one who escaped, one who did escape, that even the Union general, General Grant, said he would have traded all the 15,000 Confederates that were surrendered for the one that got away. And the one that got away was Nathan Bedford Forrest, and he tore Grant a new rear end for the rest of the war when he was out here in the Western Theater, always confused and befuddled his plans. So that was last week. So this week we're going to pick up another event in February. This one on February 17th of 1864. We're going to talk about the Confederate submarine, the CSS Hunley. And a lot of this information has come from a book, an autograph book that I have by Thomas Campbell, the CSS Hunley, Confederate Submarine. Great book. Got a lot of detailed information in there. Now, the Hunley was the first submarine in naval history to sink an enemy warship. And the Confederate submarine, the Hunley, sank the USS Housatonic outside the harbor in Charleston, South Carolina. Now, backing up a little bit, the Confederate Navy was under the direction of Stephen Mallory. He was the Secretary of the Navy, and it was a title only. The Confederacy didn't have a navy when the war started. They had a bunch of, you know, tugboats and ferries and, you know, just steamers up and down the rivers, but no naval. And so Stephen Mallory was presented with the unenviable task of building a navy and a Marine Corps from scratch. And they did get many of the Navy and USMC officers resigned to join the South's War for Independence. But unfortunately, these naval officers with a lot of experience and the Marine officers as well that came over to join the South, they couldn't bring their ships with them. And so they resigned and joined the Confederate Navy. And that's great. We're glad to have y'all, but we don't have a ship for you to command right now. So like I said, it had to be built from scratch. But one thing I would like to point out about what Stephen Mallory did with the Confederate Navy, if you include the torpedo department, which they called them torpedoes back then, we called them mines, under Gabriel Rains, and then also the Confederate Marine Corps that were manning the Navy heavy guns at the coastal forts, like Fort Fisher at Wilmington and Fort Sumter and Fort Moultrie at Charleston, and so forth up and down the coast, the Confederate Navy sank more U.S. warships than the total of U.S. ships lost from 1775 up until the morning of December 7th, 1941. So in that time span,
damn,
from 1775 to December of 1941, the Confederate Navy sank more U.S. warships than all the other ships that were lost in that time span. So from starting from nothing, that was really something. But today, we want to talk about a really ingenious Confederate invention, the CSS Hunley submarine. Now, back then it was called a diving torpedo boat, and it was designed and built by Horace Lawson Hunley. Now, he's originally from Gallatin, Tennessee, but he had moved down to New Orleans and made a lot of money in the shipping business. And there was another fellow that worked with him that's kind of lost to history, is James McClintock. And he built a two-man torpedo boat in New Orleans, and it actually sank a couple of small U.S. ships in the New Basin Lake between New Orleans and Lake Pontchartrain. It's called the CSS Pioneer. And we'll pick that up after our break and give you the information on how all this happened.
Thank you so much, Bitter Ender. Be right back, folks.
As you are aware, America is divided over every fault line possible. This is intentionally fostered by those who do not love God, family, or country. We believe a peaceful future as a free people absolutely depends on civility. Clarion Call for Civility is looking for funding and volunteers at every level to make our hopes and efforts a reality. Please donate, sign our pledge, and help us in our sacred cause. Please visit callforcivility.com for more details. callforcivility.com.
I'm Monica Schaefer from Canada, a former political prisoner. Here at Blood River Radio, we are not afraid to tell the truth and shame the devil. Our mission is to fight against white genocide. We do that by exposing the lies. We talk about the American Civil War. We talk about the vilification of German people and by extension, all white people. And we even talk about that linchpin lie, the Holocaust. Deception by the alien enemy within has brought us whites to our knees. My last words at the Schaefer's speech crime trial in Germany were, quote, "If there was a law forbidding us to breathe, we would break that law immediately just to live. And so it is with this law. We must break this law in order to survive and thrive as a people," unquote. Please donate to Blood River Radio and help keep us on the air.
Bypass the mainstream narrative with Liberty News Radio at libertynewsradio.com. Engage with charismatic hosts live or on demand. We cover the crucial news focused on God, family, and country. News that other networks simply refuse to use. Think of LNR's hard-hitting news and podcasts at your fingertips anytime, anywhere. Join us at libertynewsradio.com. Empower your day with the truth, because the truth will set you free. libertynewsradio.com.
Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for hanging on. The Bitter Ender talking about Confederate history, talking about the CSS Huntley, and I think James McClintock, another fellow that is maybe with equal, did as much about as for the Confederacy as Huntley, but I've never heard of McClintock. But go ahead, Brother Gene.
Okay, we were talking about the Huntley, first submarine to sink an enemy warship in naval history, and was the credit went to building it, actually, to Horace L. Hunley from Gallatin, Tennessee. But he moved down to New Orleans before the war, made a lot of money in the shipping business down there. And then McClintock and some other inventors had come up with the first submarine. It's called the CSS Pioneer. And they'd used it in one of the lakes between New Orleans and Lake Pontchartrain. And, of course, they couldn't do anything to Farragut's fleet steaming up the Mississippi River. And as New Orleans was about to fall, Hunley took the plans that he was working on for a much larger submersible. And he took his plans with him to Mobile, and with the help of a British-born mechanical engineer, William Alexander, built at a plant in Mobile, Park and Lyons machine shop, they built what they originally called Pioneer 2, was the second submersible, which was a lot bigger. It was 36 feet long, 3 feet wide, and 4 feet high. And this later became known as the CSS Hunley, and we'll explain why it got that name. And it's very cramped.
I guess
they had a model of this, an exact replica of the Hunla that they used to take around in the late 1990s, early 2000s, trying to raise money to get the Hunley raised off of the ocean floor right outside Charleston there. And you could sit inside of this model, and I'm 6 foot three, and I could not sit up straight in this. I had to bend over to get inside of this thing. And they had a bench, and it had a crankshaft, and there were eight men turning. It didn't have a motor or battery-powered motor, diesel, anything. It had this crankshaft, and you had to turn that, eight men turning that crankshaft, and that turned the propeller. And then when they decided to back up, they had to get the command to reverse the crankshaft and back it up. But that's what powered it. It's amazing. But the thing was, it was very modern in its design. Well, we'll get into that in a little bit later. But while we were in Mobile, they had five wealthy Southern businessmen that invested $5,000 toward the construction of a second underwater boat. And it had, in the design of it, it had forward and aft water tanks. And they would open the seacocks and let the water in to sink the submarine to the desired level. And then they had force pumps that they would pump and eject the water, and then the boat would float back up to the surface. Had no motor, like we said, the crankshaft. And it had diving fins on either side to direct the dive angle, nose and tail. And it really did, as far as the design is concerned, the Hunley looked more like these modern nuclear submarines than it did like the World War One and World War Two submarines with a sharp nose on it. Well, and then another engineer officer joined the construction crew in Mobile. His name was Lieutenant George Dixon, and he was from Alabama, and he was wounded at Shiloh. And he was sent to Mobile to recuperate. And when he was in the Confederate Army and at the Battle of Shiloh, before the war, his girlfriend, Queenie Bennett, gave him a $20 gold piece. And she kissed it and said, "This is good luck. Carry this with you." And you better be sure he was glad he did, because at Shiloh, a bullet hit him in the leg. And it just miraculously hit that $20 gold piece and bent it into a U-shape. And he was badly bruised and wounded there, but he said had it not been for that gold piece, that thing would have shattered his femur and his leg would have been taken off and he would have probably died. So after the Battle of Shiloh, he went to a jeweler and had him engrave on this bent $20 gold piece, said, "My life preserver, April 6th, 1862, which is the date of the Battle of Shiloh. And he carried that with him for the rest of his life.
My birthday.
Well, that's a great day then.
Yeah, it surely is. My birthday, April 6th. Yep. I wish I could say I was there, but I wouldn't. Yeah.
Helping the cause.
Yes.
Well, now, unlike Mobile, Charleston was under continuous attack, and the city of Charleston was under siege from just basically the end of war, the beginning of the war, till 1865. It was the siege of Charleston, South Carolina, was the longest siege of any city in the Western Hemisphere, over 3 years. Wow. And the civilians were targeted. Once the Federal Army got their heavy siege guns on Sullivan's Island and Morris Island and so forth, where they could get within range of Charleston, they had these ramps built so they could roll these big heavy artillery pieces up on these ramps and fire over the Confederate lines across the bay and into downtown Charleston. And they used the church steeples as aiming points because they knew that all the pews in these churches were filled up with wounded Confederate soldiers and wounded civilians. So they were hoping they could collapse the roof on these churches, on these wounded people that were inside the churches, and not only kill the people that were in there, but kill or severely cripple the doctors and nurses that were taking care of it. Really nice tactics that the U.S. military uses. And this was a tactic at Vicksburg, at Charleston, at Richmond, at Atlanta, and a lot of these other cities, to make war on civilians. And it's not too different of what you were talking about at Dresden, attacking, targeting civilians, or Hamburg, or Tokyo, or Nagasaki, or Hiroshima. So anyway, they decided that they needed the submarine, the Pioneer II, as it was called, left Mobile in August of 1863, and loaded it on two railroad flat cars and took it over to Charleston and got there on August the 12th. General P.G.T. Beauregard selected Lieutenant John Payne of the Confederate States Navy to be the boat's commander. And unfortunately, without enough practice and making a practice dive in Charleston Harbor, Lieutenant Payne and the crew drowned while preparing to tie up at the dock. The hatches were opened, and they assumed that somebody accidentally stepped on one of the diving planes and forced the nose down, and water rushed in through the open hatch to escape, but five of the crew members were drowned. They sabotaged the boat and got it up, and by October, it was ready to go. The boat was designed, they called it a diving torpedo boat. And the reason they did that, this boat was designed, or underwater boat, submersible, whatever you want to call it. They didn't call it a submarine back then. They called it a diving torpedo boat. And the idea was it would go down underneath a federal warship, and on a long cable, it was towing an explosive charge behind it that would float just at or just below the surface of the water. And as this diving torpedo boat went under this federal warship, it would tow this mine or torpedo explosive charge into the side of the ship opposite of where the submersible was, explode it, and sink the warship. And we'll tell you in a little while why that never did work out. So it was raised, cleaned up, and ready by October. So now Hunley decided he was going to take over and made a practice dive under a Confederate ship there in Charleston Harbor, the Indian Chief, but never came back up from the other side. And they talked about these sailors. They could see it coming toward their ship. And they thought, okay, they're just out there practicing again. It went under the Indian Chief. They walked over to the other side of the ship, but they never saw the submarine come back up. And what they found out was, once they found it, the prow of the submarine was buried in the mud, and the propeller was actually pointing straight up. What happened, they think, this submarine had these keel bolts that had these heavy weights bolted to the bottom of it to make it easier for it to go down and get under the water. And then if they got into an emergency, they had these big wrenches that would undo the nuts on these keel bolts and let them drop off, and then the air inside the Hunley or the submarine would bring it back up to the surface. And then when they recovered the bodies on November the 7th, there were eight bodies, and they determined that they hadn't released the keelboat. Somebody panicked. They were trying to pump the water out, and they forgot or couldn't get those bolts to loosen up enough to drop the weights off the bottom of it. They had a funeral, a formal military procession for the funeral for the eight members, including Captain Hunley, who died on his invention. And General Beauregard said, "At the gravesite, I could not refrain from tears." And there's a tombstone there at Magnolia Cemetery in Charleston, where the crew members and Horace Hunley were buried. And on the tombstone, it says, "Captain Horace Hunley, age 39 years, a native of Tennessee, but for many years a citizen of New Orleans, who lost his life in the service of his country." And in this book, it has a photograph of that tombstone there at Magnolia Cemetery. Then Lieutenant George Dixon took command, and he raised a third crew of volunteers. Now, I'll tell you something, Eddie. You would have to be pretty brave or borderline crazy to volunteer. Now, what am I volunteering for? Get down inside of this thing that's already drowned two crews? I think I'm going to be busy that weekend. I don't think I'll be able to do that.
And Gene, how did they keep the place light? What did they do for light on the inside?
They had candles.
Oh, wow. And oxygen.
Yeah, it was kind of like the canary in the mine. If the candle started going out, you knew you were getting in trouble.
It's time to get up to the surface, Buffer. Gee, we got to go to our bottom of the hour break. Which is a 5-minute break, where people get coffee. We'll be right back, folks.
How would you like to help this program reach more people and earn silver at the same time? Call or text 801-669-2211 for complete details.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. President Trump says his successful history with CPAC goes back ages.
I first spoke to this gathering 14 years ago, and I won your straw poll. I didn't know anything about a straw poll. They took this big straw poll, and I won by like 27 points. And I figured, you know, that's good. Maybe I should keep doing it. And I did. And I became president. Isn't that great? Who would think?
Mr. Trump addressing CPAC today in suburban Washington. GOP lawmakers in both chambers set to begin voting soon on legislation to undo a range of Biden rules.
The Senate is gearing up to begin considering Congressional Review Act resolutions in the coming weeks that would undo rules on bank mergers, methane emissions, and other matters. The Senate's top targets include a pair of resolutions introduced by Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana that would overturn a rule from the Treasury Department's Office of the Comptroller of the Currency that put new restrictions on bank mergers, and a regulation from the Interior Department's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management requiring oil and gas companies to submit archaeological reports to the agency before beginning offshore drilling, respectively. Bernie Bennett in Washington.
Also at townhall.com, there could be in the near future a summit between the presidents of the U.S. and Russia. More on the story from correspondent Donna Border.
Russia's deputy foreign minister says his country and the U.S. are preparing for a face-to-face meeting between President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Sergei Ryabkov tells Russian state media that a possible Trump-Putin summit could involve broad talks on global issues, including the war in Ukraine. But he says efforts to organize such a meeting are at an early stage. Ryabkov says U.S. and Russian envoys could meet within the next 2 weeks to pave the way for further talks among senior officials. I'm Donna Water.
And more on these stories at townhall.com.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-504-8790. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-504-8790. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-504-8790.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
I'm Michael Hill, president of the League of the South. I and my compatriots are Southern Nationalists. We seek the survival, well-being, and independence of the Southern people, our people. The League wants a South that enjoys the sweet fruits of Christian liberty and prosperity, but our current situation won't allow it. We must have our independence from Washington, D.C. and the globalists. The present system cannot be reformed. Without independence, we will continue down this path of destruction. To us, this is not acceptable. I'm asking you, Southern man and woman, to join us today to free the South. Call us at 256-757-6789 or see our website at www.leagueofthesouth.com. God save the South.
Introducing Managed IT Services from NPI. We offer top-notch data backup and recovery, email spam protection, and network security tailored to your needs and budget. With 20-plus years of experience in the medical field, our HIPAA-certified consultants know what it takes to protect sensitive information. Don't settle for less. Give us a call at 801-706-6980 and experience the difference with Managed IT Services. Remember, your IT support should be fast, efficient, and reliable.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
The being this is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off. You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Yeah, Blood River Radio family. During the break, me and Gene were talking about some of the things might happen, maybe just what happened to South Carolina. And, you know, but what the Yankees did there to Charleston, just maybe, but maybe, who knows? I'm not going to, I wouldn't wish it anybody, really, wouldn't wish it very hard on us. What happened to California? Maybe it was with the forest fires and stuff like that. Maybe, just maybe it was payback of what that Yankee government did to the Southerners all over the South. But we're talking about Charleston, South Carolina. But go ahead, take it away, Bob, Bitter Ender.
Well, it wasn't just Charleston. You look at these photographs the Yankees yes. made to brag about what they'd done to Atlanta and Richmond and Petersburg and Vicksburg and all of these other cities that were just pretty much destroyed. And that was the federal government's or the Yankee government's way of making war on civilians. And those were just the major cities. And they didn't take a lot of pictures of all the homes that were burned as the Yankee army moved through the South from Mississippi through Georgia and the Carolinas and trying to burn Columbia, South Carolina, when Sherman's army got up there. And while the fires were going, they had the fire engines out there, and the Yankee soldiers would come out with bayonets and poke holes in the fire hoses, and so they couldn't get any water pressure and put out the fires. Nice people to deal with, really nice.
Yes, very yeah. nice.
So anyway, back to Charleston, where we have already lost two crews in the Confederate submarine, the Hunley. So it was raised and refurbished on a dock across the harbor in Mount Pleasant, across from Charleston, city of Charleston. And this is where, on that dock, this is where that famous painting of the Hunley was done by Conrad Wise Chapman. And he did a whole series of paintings of the defense of Charleston. He did another one of Fort Sumter with this ragged Confederate flag flying up there and the walls of the fort all beat to pieces. And out on the horizon, you can see the federal warships of the blockade. And that was another thing that happened in Charleston. They would attack Fort Sumter during the day and just pound on it, because to them, that's where the war started. And that was the firing on Fort Sumter was the only cause of the war, not Lincoln calling for soldiers to invade the South and force us back into the Yankee Empire at gunpoint. But that was the only cause. So they just pounded on Fort Sumter relentlessly. And then at night, the Confederates would go out and rig up another flagpole from the one that had been shot to pieces and raise it back up. So when the sun came up the next morning, the Confederate flag was flying over Fort Sumter and kind of like, yeah, well, okay, we're back. You know, try it again sometime. So anyway, Captain Dixon put the third crew through an intensive training program, and their first attempt to dive under a ship was unsuccessful. What happened was the current actually pushed the explosive charge toward the Hunley. And at the last minute, had to grab this thing and push it away from it so they wouldn't blow up their own ship. So the Federals, there were spies in Charleston. The Federals got word that the Confederates had developed some kind of diving torpedo boat to go under their ships. So the blockade, monitors, these like the monitor that fought the CSS Virginia, that first battle of iron ships, the Yankees built a bunch more of them, and these monitors were in close to the forts around Charleston Harbor so they could bombard them, and were pretty much impenetrable with the iron plating and everything they had on them, although they did sink two of them. The Confederates did sink two of them. And so they kept them in there, and what they did, they dropped boom chains over the side, these like chain curtains around the sides of the ship, so that a diving torpedo boat couldn't go underneath them. If they did, the explosive charge would get caught up in these chain, like curtains, I guess you'd call it, around the ship, and blow up before it ever got to the hull. So Dixon and the Confederates in there figured this one out, And they said, well, now what we're going to have to do, we're going to have to go out further in the ocean and catch some of these ships with a wooden hull that are part of the blockade squadron around Charleston. They're out there trying to block runners from getting and bringing in supplies. So they spotted a ship out there called the USS Housatonic, and that was going to be their target. They moved the Hunley over to Battery Marshall, and it was refitted with a long pole attached to the bow. It had a metal canister with 90 pounds of gunpowder at the end of this pole with spikes on it. And then the idea was to ram it into this, and this was on this shaft, this explosive charge was. They would ram it into the hull of a ship. These spikes would stick in the hull. Then they would reverse the crankshaft and back away from it. And it had a long cable on it. And when they got back to a safe distance, it would trip a hammer inside of this metal canister. The hammer would come down on a percussion cap, and it would explode this 90-pound charge right into the hull of a ship. So that was the new plan. And they'd practiced with that, making sure they could do it. And then on the night of February 17th, 1864, and the crew powered the sub out 3 miles to their target, the USS Housatonic, and they decided to go out at night to avoid the picket boats. They had these small boats that were circling around out there looking for anything that was coming through the water and keep them away from the federal warship. They had a blue calcium lantern, and if they were successful, they were going to come back up to the surface and signal Battery Marshall, and the officers there would then light the lighthouse to show the Hunley how to get back in and to breach inlet there and not run into ground on the beach or something like that. So that was the plan. As they got close to the Housatonic, the federal sailors and Marines saw something in the water. It looked like a big log coming toward them. And they just started opening fire on it with rifle fire and homeless and revolvers. And they were just bouncing off the hull, of course. And they had surfaced to get a final sighting on where the Housatonic was. They'd gone back down under the water and started cranking as hard and as fast as they could. These guys were worn out. They had been hand cranking this thing to go out 3 miles into the ocean, and that was and very little oxygen in there. And what they had, they'd breathed, gotten it pretty much breathed up, and they raised it up. Lieutenant Dixon opened the hull to get more oxygen in there and make a final sighting on where the Housatonic was. Bullets are flying all around him, ricocheting off the hull. He closes the hatch. They take it down below the surface of the water and then start cranking just as hard and fast as they can go. All of a sudden, there's this big wham. That spar runs into the side of the Housatonic. That's the signal. They started reversing the crankshaft and backing away from it. And when they got part of the way back, they think something got tangled up in that cable. Anyway, there was a huge explosion. They felt the impact inside the Hunley, and then they kept backing it up to get away from it. And surfaced once they thought they were clear of all the wreckage coming down. And what happened was, just by luck, this explosive charge hit the Hunley toward the stern, hit the Housatonic toward the stern, and just on the other side of the hull was the rear, the aft powder magazine. And when that explosion went off, it set off a chain reaction that set off the powder magazine, and it just blew the whole back third of the Housatonic off. And they said that ship sank in about 3 minutes. And they lost, I think it was 6 of the crew members drowned in it. Most of them were holding on to the rigging, climbing up in the rigging as it was going down. And all of these other federal ships saw the explosion, and they knew something had happened over there. So they were coming over to where the Housatonic was burning and sinking to pick up the survivors. The Hunley got far enough away that could resurface and opened the hatch, and they signaled Battery Marshall with the blue calcium lantern. It meant that the attack was successful, and they were coming back in. And then closed the hatch, and they took it down, they think. They took it down to the bottom of the ocean there to wait for all these ships to go over the top of them so they wouldn't be run over by one of these big federal warships that were coming to rescue the crew of the Housatonic. They signaled, The soldiers at Battery Marshall said they saw the blue calcium lantern signal, and they lit the lighthouse, but the Hunley never came back. So for years, it was assumed that the explosion of the Housatonic in this big ship created this whirlpool, and it sucked the Hunley down with it. And they had tried searching around the wreckage. They knew where the Housatonic was. It's a pretty good-sized ship. They knew where it was, and they tried searching around there. They never could find anything of the Hunley. And at one time, they thought they had found it, but it was actually one of the boilers from the Housatonic. And in 1909, the Coast Guard or the Navy, somebody went out there with demolition charges and blew up what was left of the Housatonic. It was a problem for navigation in one of the channels coming into Charleston Harbor. And it created this huge debris field there on the bottom of the ocean outside of Charleston Harbor. And once again, they went back and searched with drag lines and everything like that, but they still couldn't find the Hunley. And for 130-something years, nobody knew what happened to it. But when we come back off the break, we'll tell you how they found the Hunley and where it is today.
If I have time, I'll ask you one quick question about the Hunley when we come back. Be right back,
folks.
Away.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at CSPOA.org. That's CSPOA.org.
Hey, this is Matt from Blood River Radio. Blood River Radio is your voice to save our land, our people, and our future. We propose Christian solutions to an anti-Christian assault on our bloodlines. We love what we do, but we cannot do it without your help. The annual operating cost of Blood River Radio is more than even a team of people should bear alone. With your donation, we can take the fight to our enemies and hold our own people accountable for their treachery against us. Please go to our website, www.bloodriverradio.com, and find a way to help us that is suitable for you. We are thankful for any cash, check, or money orders we get. We also appreciate your correspondence or letters of encouragement. Once again, please help, and thank you for joining the fight.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an Immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
Dear Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for hanging on. Me and Gene had a very interesting conversation during the break. I don't know if he has time to cover that or not, to ask the question I asked him, but if he doesn't, that's fine. We'll do it another time. Go ahead, Bitterender.
Well, you were talking about, could they bring this back in? Had it been successful, could they bring it back into port and reload it with other torpedoes? But what we have to remember was this wasn't like one of the modern submarines that fire these. It would carry, I don't know how many they carry, 12, 15 torpedoes, and they shoot them out of these openings in the side of the submarine with compressed air, and then it has a motor, electric battery-powered motor, that's driving this torpedo towards an enemy ship. So they didn't have that back then. So the idea was with the Hunley, it had this long pole or spar attached to the bow, and then they would have this round metal canister full of 90 pounds of gunpowder, but it had a hole all the way through it, and it would have spikes out on the end of this canister. So when they rammed this thing into the side of the ship and then backed up, it would slide off of this pole and remain stuck in the side of the ship. And then they had this cord attached to it, And when they kind of figured out how far they needed to be away, so this explosion, the impact in the water and the concussion that would go through the water wouldn't sink the submarine, the Hunley, as well as the enemy warship. So they figured that out, and they backed up far enough. And when that line went tight, it tripped a spring, and a hammer came down inside of that canister with the gunpowder and hit a percussion cap. And when that percussion cap went off, that's what set off the gunpowder. So it's pretty primitive, but it was very, very effective. It worked. And the 3 or 5 minutes that it was that they had to get off the Housatonic, it worked very well on that one.
It did.
It went down in a hurry. So anyway, they don't know exactly for sure what happened to the Hunley, and for about 130 years, they made the signal that it was successful, and they were coming back in, and then all of a sudden it never came back, and people were waiting on the dock to greet them and cheer them for what they'd done, but they never could find the wreckage of the Hunley. And like I said, 1909, the Navy or the Coast Guard blew up what was left of the Housatonic because it was a problem for navigation. And so Dixon and his crew were on the bottom for 135 years. In 1980 and 81, expeditions were sent out to try to find they found the Housatonic debris field, but they still couldn't find the Hunley. And then they got a diary from a soldier at Battery Marshall. And it said, we saw the blue calcium lantern from the Hunley. So then they figured out if he could see it, the Hunley was a lot closer to shore than where they'd been looking for the last 130-some-odd years. So they started looking in closer to the coastline. And in 1994, Clive Cussler, the writer that has written all of these stories about shipwrecking and wrecks and salvage and so forth, was head of an expedition to look in closer to the shore, and in May of 1995, they found the Hunley. And even then, there was a lot of controversy about it. They were trying to raise money to get it brought up to the surface, and they went down there, the divers did, when they finally found it. Other than one hole in the hull of the Hunley, it was in pretty good shape. And they think that that wasn't from the explosion. It was back toward the rear of it, or the stern. They think probably a ship had drug an anchor across there at some time and caught that and ripped a hole in it. But as the U.S. government always does, they tried to screw the people in South Carolina. They said that this belonged to the United States Navy because the Confederate government was no longer operational. There was no longer a Confederate government. So anything that had belonged to the Confederate States government or Confederate States Navy now belonged to the United States Navy. And they were going to raise it up and take it to some naval museum in Annapolis or Boston or someplace like that and have it on display there. And the people in South Carolina were outraged that they'd been raising money and now the U.S. Navy and the U.S. government's going to step in and take it away from them. And Senator Strom Thurmond, the oldest living senator still serving in the United States Senate, got up and made a speech about the Hunley and said he was so upset and so depressed and just he would have to take to bed and couldn't even get up to come to the Senate and vote on the naval appropriations bill. He didn't think it was going to be able to pass, and he just couldn't vote for that. And so when the Navy found out they weren't going to get their money that they had requested, they changed their mind and very grudgingly said, well, okay, all right. They can keep the damn thing down there in South Carolina.
Money talks. So
in 2000, it was raised. They got it up. It was interesting the way they did it. They dug underneath it and got these big rubber, kind of like big long rubber balloons underneath there and got them underneath there like straps underneath it. And then they pumped air into those. And that inflated those straps that were underneath the Hunley, and then they big cranes on board these barges raised it up to the surface. And they had all of these ships, small boats, and everybody out there around watching where they were doing this. They had to keep them away at a certain distance. But when that thing hit the surface, I mean, there were horns blowing and people cheering and everything. It was quite an event. And they took it back into the harbor in Charleston, and it was placed in a naval conservatory there. And I actually got to see it one of the trips we made to Charleston after it was raised in 2005. And they had it in a big tank of water and chemicals in there to try to preserve it, to keep it from rusting. And you had to walk up on a platform, and you could, but at least you could look down and actually see the Hunley. And in the museum, this was really interesting. They had in a glass case with a spotlight on it, Lieutenant Dixon's gold coin that was found when they were had gone inside. The archaeological crew had gone inside. Wow. And I remember there was a lady, I think she was from Germany, that was head of this archaeological crew that was cleaning out the inside of the Hunley. And what they found were 8 skeletons that were still sitting on the bench. And so there were all sorts of speculations that, you know, something had hit it and it sprung a leak and went down. And now they think that when the Hunley went down to the bottom there to let the federal ships go over them, they stayed down too long. And the crew just asphyxiated and died sitting there, just like you go to sleep and you don't wake up.
Oh.
Because they didn't find the skeletons. When Hunley and his crew went down, they found the skeletons all over, or the bodies. They weren't skeletons yet. Bodies all over by the hatches, trying to push the hatch open and get out and all that sort of thing. And they had stayed underwater so long, they had to actually chop the bodies up with hatchets and pass the pieces out through the hatch. They had swollen up so much by being underwater, they couldn't get them out through the hatch. So, but this time, they found the skeletons just sitting on that bench. And like I said, like they just sat down, they went to, the oxygen was used up, they went to sleep, they never woke up again. So that was the latest theory on what happened to the crew. And then I was very, very fortunate that our reenactment group, Huol's artillery battery, went down there for the burial service for Dixon and the crew members, the third crew of the Hunley. And they had a funeral procession that started down the battery in Charleston. That's at the tip of the Charleston Peninsula that sticks out into the harbor there. And it started down there and went 4 miles up to Magnolia Cemetery. And the 8 members were in caskets. They had horse-drawn caissons, just like a military funeral, with the caskets on the caissons. And, of course, they were draped with the Confederate flag. They said there were about 4,000 to 5,000 reenactors that marched in that funeral procession. And they had a lot of the women in the funeral procession that were dressed in the black mourning dresses. Wow. And they had the bodies on display at a church there in, the caskets were, not the bodies. But they had an artist that, from the skulls they found, had done drawings of what they think these 8 people looked like. Now, they did have a photograph of Lieutenant Dixon that was made probably prior to the war, and they had a photograph of him, but the others were just seamen and working class. They didn't have the money to get a photograph done. So he did the 7 more drawings of what they think the crew looked like, and they had them sitting up on an easel right beside each one of these caskets. And then the next day, they had the funeral procession that went up to Magnolia Cemetery, and they were buried right next to Hunley and the crew that he lost, and then the 5 that were lost in the first crew of the Hunley. So they're all buried in one section of Magnolia Cemetery there in Charleston. So if you ever go to Charleston, that'd be a great place to go to see where the 3 crews are buried. And then that Naval Conservatory, now they have the Hunley out of that tank of water, and you can go there and see it sitting in that museum. So that's a little bit of our Confederate history for February. The construction and the last trip of the Confederate submarine, the Hunley. And they even had in the United States Navy a submarine tender called the USS Hunley in honor of the first submarine. And I'm sure they probably changed that to name to the Martin Luther King submarine tender or something like that, or some transgender hero of theirs. But they did have a submarine tender that takes care of these submarines out on the high seas, that they don't want to bring the submarine all the way back to port. They supply them with oxygen tanks and food and whatever they need out there. So
that had to be really eerie to be able to see that ship to that old.
It was something else. It really was a very emotional afternoon to see that. episode.
I bet it was.
I hope
like
our
seeing.
Listeners enjoyed our Confederate history for February and for today's program. And if you ever get to Charleston, you can see the Hundley.
Well, I would like to thank you so much, Peter Ender, for doing that. That's amazing. It's the interest never dies down. It's always super interesting. It gives me the chills to think about that. But thank you so much again, Gene, for coming on, brother. And thank you, Miss Teenage America, for running a flawless board. Thank you, Don Wassel, and thank you, Paul Farr, and thank you, Plugger Radio Audio. Same time, same place next week. Good night.